secrets of the house are just beyond these walls.
They hide in long forgotten shadows.
In everyone's life, there is darkness and light.
There is blindness.
There is sight.
Men and women die. Christians lose their faith. Scholars falter in their wisdom.
In one woman's life, there's an end, there's a start for the secrets of the house. Are like the secrets of the heart.
My name is Jane Eyre.
Welcome to the Broadway Radio Show. I'm Donald Feltham. And on this episode, we are going to do another Broadway flashback. And I have Paul Gordon here. Hi, Paul.
Hey, how's it going?
I'm good. And we're here because we are going to go back in time to talk about the musical Jane Eyre, for which Paul received a Tony Award nomination for Best Score. The show, of course, also was nominated for Best Musical. Paul, you may remember, was on a couple months ago, to talk about the album released for his most recent musical, The Gospel According to Heather, which is now out. I think it's out now, out on CD, correct?
Yeah, I believe so.
Yeah, so it's out on physical CD. So if you want to pick up the cast recording for that off-Broadway musical, which is a real delight. It's a very fun score by Paul. It's called The Gospel According to Heather. You can pick that up. You can also visit Paul's website to see all the other musicals he's been working on, which there are a multitude of musicals that Paul has written, which we will talk about at the end. But the main focus we're going to talk about is to talk about Jane Eyre as we do a little flashback and kind of look back in time at this kind of show that brought Paul to the attention of a lot of us Broadway fans. But before we get started, I want to talk, because the show opened in December of 2000 at the Brooks Atkinson Theater, where it ran 209 performances and picked up 5 Tony Award nominations, including Best Musical, Best Score, Best Book, Best Lighting Design, and Best Actress in a Musical for Marla Schaffel. I saw the show actually in its pre-Broadway tryout down at La Jolla Playhouse before it headed to Broadway. I wanted to kind of go back and talk to the listeners first about who you were prior to your involvement with Jane Eyre, what your career was like before that, and then how you got involved with Jane Eyre. So why don't you get started?
Yeah, thanks, Donald. So prior to Jane Eyre, I was basically a pop songwriter. I was a staff writer for, I started at EMI, then I went to Warner Brothers, then I went to Chapel Music, then Warner Brothers and Chapel merged, and I was a Warner Chapel writer. Then I left that company, went back to EMI, then I went to Geffen, and then I went to Universal Music, which was the last publishing company I worked for right before I started writing Jane Eyre. I grew up in rock bands. I was a singer-songwriter, but I'd also written a musical with my writing partner, Jay Gruska, a rock musical that we wrote called Greetings from Venice Beach. That one version had, Katie Sagal in it, who was in the most recent version of The Gospel According to Heather, and also Pamela Adlon. If your listeners are familiar with her career, wonderful actress, Emmy Award nominated actress. We developed this rock musical that all took place in Venice Beach. We had a couple of productions of it. People loved it. We got amazing reviews, but we lived in LA. We had no idea what to do with it. That was not my world. My world was pop music. Mm-hmm. I saw Les Miserables. I had always been a huge musical fan and wanted to write musicals. I was immensely blown away by Stephen Sondheim. The album of A Little Night Music changed my life when I was in college. And so I had an interest, but, I was pretty successful as a pop songwriter. I had a couple of number one hits. I had
which a were? Can you tell us what they were?
Which I had Next Time I Fall by Peter Cetera and Amy Grant. Mm-hmm. I had Amy Grant's first crossover hit. And then at the same time, this little obscure song that Jay Gruska and I wrote called Friends and Lovers, which was a song they'd used on the soap Days of Our Lives. And then that became a pop hit, Carl Anderson. Mm-hmm. And then and Gloria Loring, who was on the show. And then there was a country version by Eddie Rabbit and Juice Newton. And every version was a hit. And it was just, like I'd been on a lot of records at that point. I'd written songs with David Foster. I'd had Quincy Jones produce my songs. So I was doing well, but I hadn't had a hit. So that was really kind of life-changing. And it really allowed me to actually have a recording studio in my house in Laurel Canyon at the time. And this was before home studio. So I had a pro audio studio, which set me up. A year or two later, I got very disillusioned with writing pop music. I was just done. And I really wanted to write musicals. So I saw Les Mis, and I was just impressed by the fact that they had musicalized this classic novel. And I just remember going home going, I wonder if I could do that. And then I also said to myself, man, if I could just work with the people who worked on this show, my life would be great. 10 years later, I was working with the director, the costume designer, and the scenic designer, which was just amazing to me. That just, hey, if I could only work with these people. And then I did. But at the time, I didn't have any Broadway connections or anything. And really, I had written one rock musical, but didn't really understand yet how to write musicals. So I just decided to do it on my own. I just went, I wonder if I could do this. So I was at the Logan airport going to a friend's wedding. And at the airport in the bookstore, there was just this classic book section. I'll never forget, just this little stand. And it just said classic books. And I went, oh, maybe I can find something here just as an exercise for myself to see if I could write something. Mm-hmm. And I saw three books, Jane Eyre, Villette, also by Charlotte Bronte, and Little Women. For whatever reason, I started reading Jane Eyre first on the plane. By page 10, I was in absolute tears, and I could not wait to write the show. But I remember forcing myself to finish the novel before I started writing, because I just started hearing music in my head as soon as I started reading. So it was really a struggle not to write music. But as soon as I finished the novel, I remember just like being at the piano. And I feel like the first melody I wrote was at what's now called the graveyard, as I lay myself down to sleep tonight.
Helen, I have brought you a lily today, for the roses were frail and the petals fell away. The morning mist has kissed your grave. Rest now and sleep. Our secrets we'll keep till we speak again tomorrow. When I lay myself down to sleep tonight, I pray I might know why God has tempered judgment, not with mercy, but with sorrow. Let the world forsake me, let them do their worst. I will withstand it all, they will not break me. There is another world that watches us, I'm not afraid.
Rebellion waits, the silent cry, my spirit.
spirit sings goes far beyond these gates. Oh, heaven, what a wait.
And then the next melody I wrote was the parents' theme, which was not in the Broadway version, but will be in the next version of Jane Eyre that we do.
Mm-hmm.
So that's sort of the beginning of pre-Jane Eyre, and then just the idea of writing it. Oh, I'm going to write this musical now.
Right, but then it's another big step to actually get John Caird involved, and actually, I mean, it's it's a big leap from picking a book up in the airport and reading it and deciding you're going to write music to suddenly getting people from Les Mis actually involved, right?
Yes, because I think the greatest words of wisdom for writers and people in the industry that I've ever heard is it's not what you do, it's who you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I knew no one. So I was really in a position of I'm just writing this for myself because I don't know what to do with this and what would I do with it. So I'm writing it, but while I'm recording the demo in my 24-track studio, I'm using my friend Sally Dworsky as Jane Eyre. Now, Sally is a pop singer and somebody I'd worked with for years, but she also happened to be understudying Eponine in the LA production of Les Mis. That was the touring production. They used locals for the understudy. So Sally went on, and so I saw the show. That's how I saw the show the first time. Then I started using her. Then she slowly started bringing cast members from the show to do my demo. Here's the connection. Finally, towards like, this is like a year that I'm writing the show and slowly doing this demo. And towards the end of the process, she brings in Anthony Crivello, who plays a servant in the original demo, just at the end. And of course, Anthony is immediately, oh, I could be Rochester. Very smart, because he was a great Rochester. But he says, oh, my friend John Caird should hear this. And that was it, Donald. That was literally the bridge between me, pop songwriter, don't know anything about Broadway or how to get anywhere, to somebody sings on my demo who knew John Caird, who happened to be in LA at the time working on the show. And so he sends John a cassette. Yes, it was a cassette of the music and my first draft of the book, which I had written everything myself, and he sends it to John. And John at this moment is the, you know, he and Trevor Nunn are the most successful directors in the world. They have the most successful show in the world. They are on top of the world. John's getting 50 cassettes a week from people that want to do musicals with him. So he listens to Jane Eyre and he calls me and he goes, hey, I think this is pretty good. But you're American. You don't know how to write this, really. So I suggest you place it in the 20th century in the Midwest. And me, like, I don't even know how I did this, but I went, oh, no, I don't want to do that. Silence on the phone. I might have just lost every opportunity I had my career to move forward. I didn't even know that in the moment. But he paused and he went, all right, well, why don't you come over next week and let's talk about it. So I go over to his Westwood house. We're in the backyard and he has a red pencil with my printout. And God knows why I didn't use spell check. I still have no idea. I mean, it was Mindy's food house. So he's in the backyard correcting my spelling with a red pencil and going, this isn't British. This is American. This isn't 19th century. And I'm thinking, he hates me. He hates me especially. So then after he's done, he goes, well, I don't know how you know how to do this, but you do. And if you would let me write the book, I would like to direct this. And my life changed in that moment. That was just everything. Everything changed from then on. And I was working with John Caird to this day. He is still my number one writing partner and my brother.
And so then talk about timeline of this, because I know that it gets to, is Manhattan Theater Club, is Manhattan Theater Club the first workshop?
Yes, that's right. The first thing we do. And I guess that must be 95.
Yeah.
And it was the first time that I'd work with John in the room, and we'd work with actors. We cast the show. That's where we found Marla Schaffel. Anthony Crivello, of course, was our Rochester. And we had other great, wonderful people working with us at that time, and other people that actually went on to do the Broadway production. So that was the first time I saw John stage anything. And the first thing he ever did, which just blew my mind, the first moment of the show at that moment was the parents singing about how they're dying, and Jane is 10 years old, and John has staged it so that the baby, Jane as a baby, is wrapped in a blanket. And then the little actress who's 10 years old, who plays, he had her stand behind Marla, and then she just takes the blanket, and it's a shawl that she puts over the little girl. And that just happens in the first 10 seconds. And it just gave me the chills. And it was the first thing he ever did. And I went, oh, I'm working with total genius. Mm-hmm. And to this day, it's just like, he lifts me up. And when you work with other artists that lift you up, it is just an incredible feeling. So that I just fell in love with him and his genius. And we were off and running. So Manhattan Theater Club was the first anything that we did. And honestly, it was pretty terrible. It was like 3 hours long. We didn't know, you know, the show was just, it was just like we threw it together. You know, John's notes to me in those days were like, write a song about the flowers, write a song about this blade of grass. You know, so we had like so much music. It was so long. Our trouble all along is that we were trying to be so true to the novel that we ended up performing the novel on stage, basically, in most of the first several productions.
Right. And that's, you know, I think that's always the tricky part, is that sometimes you can't, when you're doing an adaptation, you have to adapt. Yes. And that's the problem.
Have your own interpretation. That's right. Why it's adaptation, why right. It's not. I am literally putting everything Charlotte Bronte ever said on the stage because I want to be true to her.
Right. Because if you do that, you're going to end up with a multi-evening saga, which is, you know, and that doesn't always work.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's interesting because, you know, I was working with the director who had so much success with two shows. Les Miserables, which we know is 3 hours long. Mm-hmm. Over 3 hours long on Broadway, and Nicholas Nickleby,
right,
which was 9 hours long. Mm-hmm. And what is John's other genius? He's a Shakespearean director. Mm-hmm. So his sensibility was always, we can tell a big story and audiences are very patient. But as we get into the 90s, audiences' attention spans start to get less and less.
Right.
And culture is changing. And the big, you know, UK musicals of the 80s, like suddenly, obviously, when we opened in 2000, and I know I'm jumping ahead a little bit, you know, people were like, yeah, we did that. We're right. Ready for the next thing.
Right. Yeah. Because, I mean, it's interesting because I agree with you. I think the Les Mis was sort of, it's interesting because Les Mis was sort of like the peak of that genre.
Yes.
And it it's funny because they were almost a singular peak, because even leading up to it, there was nothing very similar to it. And then everything after it was a really steep, steep, fast, rapidly declining slope that the audiences, once there was a Les Mis, nothing else could really match.
What else did they need to see that
right.
was?
Right.
And then
everything after it was sort of either a pale imitation, and then audiences, patience for that kind of stuff wore out really fast. If it wasn't Les Mis, they didn't want to see anything else. So, and it just didn't work. So, but it seemed like after Manhattan Theater Club, it was because when I started looking up dates and kind of creating a little bit of a timeline for myself, you know, 1995 was Manhattan Theater Club workshop. But then you've got 1996 is the world premiere in Toronto. It's fast. I mean, you guys, that's a pretty rapid turnaround for Toronto.
Yes. So I believe John had a relationship with David Mirvish,
right,
who was the big producer in Toronto.
Yeah.
You know, his dad, Ed Mirvish, owned like most of downtown Toronto. So they were keen to do the show. John forged that relationship. And suddenly, and that was amazing for me. Yeah. So I think it's 96.
Yeah, 96. Yeah.
96. So I go to Toronto. I'm having the, well, obviously Wichita is before that. And we can maybe skip over that for a second.
Yeah, there's a workshop at the Center Theater workshop.
So Toronto is obviously the first class production of my life. And I remember the first day walking into rehearsal room, this huge space, and there are two pianists on each side of the room, and they're playing my music. And I just never experienced that before. Mm-hmm. I just never experienced like, oh, somebody who isn't me is like looking at music and playing music and they're working on the scores, and I don't even know who they are. And there are like 100 people in the room. And it was like, it was the first moment that I realized, and this was something that I try to hang on to for each show, is that I created this. Like, this was an idea in my head. I wrote it. I didn't know what I was doing. And now there's like hundreds of people working on this thing. I've given so many people a job. Mm-hmm. I'm not getting paid, but everybody else is getting paid. And it's amazing. And it was just an incredible experience. I loved John Napier. I met John Napier for the first time. He designed the single unit set, Donald, that was just brilliant. I mean, it's basically the set of Hamilton. I mean, mm-hmm. that's the set he designed. And it was so brilliant and so perfect. I loved it. The logo that the De Winters created, that were, they created the Les Mis logo, the Miss Saigon logo, all the great logos of the day. Mm-hmm. And they created this beautiful image that you've seen, which is the face in the tree. That's the sort of the optical. Yes.
I'm holding the CD up because I have the Toronto CD.
The optical illusion. So everything great, and it was just an amazing experience. And then I had to grow up really, really fast because, well, I'll tell you. I'll just skip around. I don't know. And tell me.
Yeah, you can skip around. You can skip around.
So my favorite moment of the whole thing was Larry Hockman creating the orchestrations for Jane Eyre for the first time, because in Wichita, you know, we had synths. Like, he was writing the orchestrations, but we didn't have the musician. So there was like a synth. Maybe there was a violin player. I don't remember. So I'm really hearing the orchestrations for the first time. And I'll never forget, I'm in the back of this rehearsal room. And, you know, Larry's just talking to the orchestra and doing his thing. I'm in the back with a slice of pizza and a Diet Coke. And I'm just like, not going to say anything. I'm just there on my own. And then I just start to hear it. And it's just, I just can't even tell you how that affected me.
What can I do now, my precious Lord? His dark love would be my best reward. I know I should not dare to go deeper in his madness, but it's like a field I must run through. No one's words will make me love him less. How much can I stand? I dare not guess. The secret voice that speaks to me tells me he's in danger, looking to the dust for tenderness. Deep in my secret soul, I stand alone. The purpose of why I'm here is still unknown. In the darkness of his day, he's nearly blind, but I keep looking for his goodness, afraid of what I'll find. My heart moves through his unquiet sea. I pray a wave will come and carry me. troubled tide, waters of his fury. But how can I swim this great divide? Deep in my secret soul, I cry his tears. I weather his angry voice. I feel his fears. His life has infected every wound and every pore. I feel his mystery.
Hearing my music for the first time, I think we had a 17-piece orchestra in Toronto. And of course, again, talking about being lifted up, John lifted me up, production director. Larry Hockman's genius lifted me up musically. Mm-hmm. And it's just amazing when that happens. I have no ego about it. It's like, you made me better. Like what people respond to musically, I know a lot of it is me, but a lot of it is Larry Hockman. Right. And I will always give him credit for that. So that was an amazing experience. And the whole thing was great. So now we get to opening night. And, you know, we don't know anybody there. We don't have any friends there. It's just, I mean, I guess I have a few family members there. But basically, it's 1,000 strangers in the room. And I'd never heard an audience respond this way. It was just, they freaked out. It was like unbelievable. At the end of the show, they were on their feet. They were crying. It was like, I couldn't believe it. It's like, oh my God, my life has been made. I have a hit. Everything is great. So the next morning, the reviews come out. So the first, there were two reviews. There was the Toronto Star and there was the Globe and Mail. So unfortunately, the Globe and Mail came to my hotel room, delivered to my door, probably to this day, the worst review I've ever read for any of my shows and the worst review I've ever gotten myself. Like saying, I remember one part of the review went, like, oh, but all this awfulness could have been saved had the music been listenable. Had there been one moment in the music that was, you know, that was good, essentially, whatever the wording was. I couldn't believe, I was so shocked because I'd heard that audience. So I had such a disconnect that an audience could do that. And then a critic could be there and like experience like this thunderous thing and everything the audience is feeling. Not mention it in the review, and then just say how bad the show was. So that was shocking to me. And then the Toronto Star came out that evening with, of course, a glowing review, but it didn't matter to me. That was my first experience of getting a shockingly bad review when I didn't expect it for a show I'd worked on for 10 years. Mm-hmm. And, or I guess not like 6 years at that time or 7 years. And I had to grow up, and it took a while.
Right.
It was very, very challenging. And eventually I got over it, or maybe a little part of me never got over that. And that's just, you know, as artists, what we have to face, that kind of criticism from people that have tin ears that don't know anything, or maybe they do know stuff and they just don't like what you do.
Right.
So that's just a challenge.
Right. You're not going to please everybody all the time. And not everybody likes the same things, and not everybody likes everything. And you just have to, I mean, and you know, we all experience that even with just our friends. You can go with a group of friends to see a show and not everybody loves it. And you're baffled sometimes because you sit there and you think, oh my God, I love the show. I love the show. And you talk to your friend who you assumed would have loved the show. And then they're like, oh, I hated it. And you're like, can't understand how they could have hated it.
Oh, it's so weird. And, you know, I've been a professional songwriter for so long and, of course, got my work rejected left and right, you know, trying to get on this artist's record. And it's like, no, they don't like it. But somehow this was so much bigger because I put my whole soul into it. And I was so convinced by the audience and by everybody who talked to me, like how great it was. So I was so shocked that somebody could feel the opposite and write about it in print and that people would believe it as truth. So that was
right. And that's the hard part. Well, it is the hard part because it's because what I think a lot of and I talked to I grew up doing theater, and a lot of people who don't do theater and have never done theater, and this is now your first real theater experience, and it's an hugely immersive experience for you to have for your first experience.
Yeah.
Being in theater is an incredibly communal, familial experience. When you're in a show and part of a show, no matter what you're doing in the show, whether you're a crew person or a tech person or in the cast or one of the creators, it's a gigantic family. It's a gigantic creative, cooperative environment. And it becomes such a collaborative effort that everyone feels so invested in it. And you live in this huge family that's this huge, gigantic love fest. And you become very protective of your baby. And the show is your baby. And everybody loves it and they want it. And it's hard when someone outside the circle says bad things about the baby. And it just is. It's hard because everybody, and you all love each other and you all love the experience and you all feel so emotional about what you're doing and how you're having such a great time that it can be really rough to step outside it and take a different look at it and hear other opinions. But what you get out of it and what we all get out of it when we do theater is the experience and the create and working with creative people and sharing creative ideas and collaboration. And that's why we do it.
That's right. And then Stephen Schwartz taught me that what you do is, first of all, when you get to Broadway, like don't even read the reviews. What is the macro point? Somebody will give you the score. And, but pre-Broadway, it's like, read them all, but read them all at one time in one sitting. That was the big lesson. Like had I had the Globe and Mail and the Toronto Star at the same time, it might've eased the blow a little bit easier. And I see, and because what that does as the author is it gives you a different perspective. Instead of reading one review that hated it or one review that loved it, what you're doing is getting the consensus because there's always going to be outliers. But what is everybody saying? Yeah. Is there a thread that is a criticism that we should pay attention to? That's useful.
Yeah.
So, but I didn't understand there's going to be an outlier. And don't let that ruin your life.
Right. And in a town like Toronto or a place like that, where you only have two major newspapers, where you are only going to get two samplings, that's difficult because one of them can be an outlier and that throws off your balance because you're only taking two samples. Whereas you get to someplace like New York, where you have a dozen or more reviews, you get a better sampling. Your sampling size is bigger, you know?
What's interesting now that we're just talking about reviews, because I know we'll talk about Broadway, but just talking about Broadway and reviews. So Jane Eyre got pretty much rave reviews from all the New York papers, except one, and the only one that mattered. And what happened to us is that Ben Brantley had reviewed the show in Toronto as his critic's notebook. He reviewed Jane Eyre and Ragtime. Mm-hmm. And he had kind of harsh things to say about Ragtime, but which he said in his review of Broadway eventually as well. But he liked us, and he had suggestions.
Right,
we took them to heart, and I'll never forget the line he said, which we really took to heart. We hadn't finished the job yet, but he said something like, you know, saying the Lord's Prayer on the head of a pin. Because the show had to move so fast. And it's a novel, so you have to do that anyway. But you don't want it to feel that way. Right. So we took that criticism to heart. And then what happened? Ben Brantley got the flu, couldn't come to see our show.
Right.
And the second stringer came and hated it. And that really destroyed
it. Right. And that's usually opposite of New York Times policy, I think, usually. Because usually when they have a critic review the show out of town or whatever, when it does move in, the same critic usually goes back to see it, I think.
Yes. And he wanted to.
Yeah.
And if he was the main critic and it was a Broadway show, of course he would have reviewed it, but he got.
Yeah.
So, you know, things happen.
Things happen. I know. So to talk about, because so you've now done Toronto. And
yes.
So interestingly enough, as I was holding up, even though people are only listening and can't see, you do get a cast recording out of Toronto, which is kind of surprising because as we know, this whole thing is geared towards getting a show to Broadway. Let's face it. That's the whole point of doing a production in Toronto, is it's sort of like, this is a tryout. This is a chance to get the show up on its feet. The ultimate goal at the end of the line is to get the show to New York. I mean, that's the concept. But it's kind of interesting that they went and they did a cast recording, which was surprising.
I think they recognized that getting the music out into the world would be helpful to get people excited, because I only had these demos.
Right.
And now we had this beautiful orchestration, and the record was produced by one of my writing partners, Jay Gruska, who I still work with. And so we were really fortunate to have that record, because I do think it helped move the show forward, even though, you know, I can't listen to part of that record because it's very reflective of some of the early demos that I sort of grew out of. But I also appreciate that, you know, this was my journey.
Well, right. And I think I personally like the fact that when shows do this kind of thing, because you do then have sort of a historical record of the development of the show, because you can see how the show develops over time and see the changes that were made and see how things change from a writing standpoint. And you can see improvements, and sometimes you can see sometimes where things go wrong, where things have, changes have been made that you kind of go, oh, I wish they hadn't changed that because it was so much better in the earlier recording. But ultimately you end up at La Jolla. And what were the, and that was like 3 years later, 3 years, 1999. So that's 3 years later.
What happened was, and so after we did Toronto, I'll never forget it. So as I said, Ragtime was there at the same time. And, you know, I got to meet Audra. I got to meet Stephen Flaherty. It was just great. You know, we sort of had a camaraderie. We supported each other. So I'll never forget that John Caird, David Mervish, and I went to see Ragtime together. And our production, again, had a single unit set, had the greatest designers in the world, looked amazing, but it was more of an intimate show than this big epic thing that I think David Mervish wanted. And I'll never forget like the feeling I had seeing the show with him in the room, because the show, first of all, the show was great. And secondly, it had an amazing production value that was very different than our production value. I actually don't think one was better than the other. They were just very different. But we were in a world that was wanting that big Broadway thing that Ragtime had.
Well, Ragtime's telling a different story, because Ragtime is telling a really epic story with a lot of different characters that you're following and different plot lines. And Jane Eyre is inherently a more intimate story. It just is.
Exactly. Well, what I will tell you is that a month later, he pulled out of the show. He just went, I can't compete with this. I don't have the money to compete with this. And he also said, and I'll never forget it, he said, they're cooking their books, because there's no way. I know what their budget is, and I know what our budget is, and I know there's no way they can do this without doing something illegal. And, you know, sure enough,
yeah.
he was He would, yes. We know how that story ended.
Yes, so, Mr. Drabinski. We know how that ended. Yes.
So David Mirvish drops out of the show. I'm devastated. He calls me on the phone. It was like a 10 second call. Hi, Paul. I'm just calling to let you know that I'm pulling out of the show. Okay. Bye bye. Like literally, that was it. And we had nothing. We were just like, we had done all this work, and it's just like we just lost our Broadway show. Mm-hmm. But fortunately, we had other producers come in, women producers that were very, very passionate about the show and had their own ideas about what the show should do. And so we started working with them. And we did several more readings and development, and then they raised the money to go to La Jolla. Uh-huh. But of course, it took 3 years, uh-huh. and we did a lot of work on the show, and they wanted to change the set and the logo, which devastated me because they were perfect, but I just went, all right, that's what we're doing, and. I think, you know, just talking in general about the journey, La Jolla Broadway, because now this is essentially the same show. Like right. The show that we're developing in La Jolla is the show that's going to transfer to Broadway. It's essentially right. The same cast. You know, I was trying to think before we got on this call, like, I sort of don't remember that the design was exactly the same. I don't think it was, but I think it was similar. But then when we got to Broadway, they did a lot more work on those turntables and that carousel.
Well, because I saw, like I said, I saw it in La Jolla, and I know, for example, you said they changed the artwork logo. I mean, because they made it a little bit more modern looking, clean and modern looking.
I don't think the Broadway logo happened until
Broadway, right?
That Sunday New York Times thing where
right.
Nobody had seen it, including me, John Caird, and John right. Napier. But they had done something different, probably. I don't remember what the logo, or maybe they used the face in the tree. I don't know if they had permission at that time.
Right.
I can't remember.
Right. But I do, my impressions of the La Jolla production were that it was, I really loved the show when I saw it in La Jolla. But partly because La Jolla is such a fantastic theater to see a show in. It's such a gorgeous space. It's perfect for a show like this because it's very intimate. It's not a gigantic, huge space. It's not like seeing something here in LA at the Amundsen or someplace like that. It's not a gigantic theater, but it has a big stage, so you can do a Broadway sized show in the space. So it really fit the show really well. I love the score. The performances across the board were fantastic. I will admit, even though I know it became a real kind of a bugaboo, and I know it became a bit problematic once they got to New York, is even though I felt in some ways the show was a little overwhelmed by some of the technology, I was blown away by the tech. I have never in my life ever seen the carousel thing that they did. I mean, that was the first time I'd ever seen that. That was, but people, listeners are not going to know what we're talking about. But obviously we, by that point, because of Les Mis and stuff, we were so used to seeing a turntable, but this was basically a turntable, but above. I mean, the light, the rigging.
And
the
we
lights,
had three
the,
below.
Yeah. I mean, there were turntables on the stage, but they also, the lights and everything were also on a turntable above.
Oh. Yes,
including, I mean, the rails and everything, all the stuff was hanging on a rotating turntable above the set. So pieces above were also on turntables. So everything that was coming in, all the drops and everything that were coming in were also rotating and spinning. So it had this incredible cinematic feel to the way sets moved in and out and scenes were changing, which was absolutely stunning to watch. I mean, the way the technology was choreographed on stage was mind-blowing. But I know that it became a bit problematic when they got to New York and had to, like, if I remember correctly, they had to do some reinforcing to the Brooke Atkinson Theater because that thing was so heavy to install in the theater, they had to do reinforcing to the ceiling.
They had to spend another $1 million.
Right.
Well, I'm going to get to...
But yeah, we'll get there. So talk about La Jolla first.
Yeah. So La Jolla was actually just really enjoyable for me. I was living in LA, so it was really easy. And it was just driving down in my car and just being there, you know, in sunny California, where I grew up, and doing my show in a place where a lot of my friends could finally see the show. And again, you know, we were reviewed by everybody, and the reviews for La Jolla were mixed, very mixed. And again, like, didn't feel great. But again, we had a new team. And I think the difficulty that we suffered in La Jolla, that we also suffered in Broadway, were too many cooks, too many people giving too many opinions, and we listened to everyone. And we went, oh, well, we should do that. Oh, we should do that. And we did everything. And that was the opposite of what we should have done. So, and I'm going to connect this to Broadway because this is really an important thread for me. When we got to Broadway, we were no longer working on the show. We had done all the work that, like, all the book work that people told us to do post La Jolla, pre-Broadway, so that by the time we were in rehearsal and in previews for Broadway, John Caird and John Napier, you know, rightfully so, because this was their job, they were done with the show. It's all about the look now. But of course, we had weeks and weeks to work on the show. We had to work on the music and the storytelling because the show was still way too long. And there were obvious places to cut, and there were obvious things we needed to do. But whenever I went, hey, we need to work on this, I was told, I'm sorry, it will take 2 weeks to reprogram the carousel in order to do that. So even though theater people like yourself and lighting designers saw this technology and went, this is mind-blowing, most audiences went, oh, this looks great, but I want to go home now because this is too long and I'm not following.
That's the bugaboo with the technology, with the theater stuff now, is that if you make cuts, the technology hinders too many changes because it's all computerized.
So I was so devastated in previews because I knew the show wasn't ready. Mm-hmm. I could see it. I could feel it. And it didn't even have the same emotional impact at the ending that it had in Toronto. Mm-hmm. And, you know, part of that was there was something about Marla Schaffel and Anthony Crivello together that was really very, very powerful. James Barber was also great in the role. But there was a certain vulnerability that Anthony had that just landed, but that was a change the producers wanted to make for Broadway, for their reasons that I won't get into. I feel like it was such an amazing learning experience for me as an artist, because I learned everything that you should do and everything that you shouldn't do in that experience. And it was both breathtaking and devastating, all in pockets of, oh, now I'm nominated for a Tony Award. Like, this is incredible. A week later, the New York Times wrote an article on how I didn't deserve it. I mean, it was just like unbelievable to me. Like, can I just enjoy this for more than a week before a critic goes, no, your music isn't good and you did not deserve this? I don't know why. I don't know who this person was, like why they needed to write an article about it negatively. So it was quite a life experience for me, and one that I am so grateful for every level of it, for every moment that I was uncomfortable, every moment that I was elated, all the gift of these incredible artists that I've worked with, from Larry Hockman to John Napier to Steve Tyler, who was our music director. Everybody was brilliant. There wasn't a weak artist It's just was the situation and the whirlwind of Broadway and of the pressure and mm-hmm. and just like, here's how you should do it and here's how you shouldn't do it.
Right. Going back a little bit, because one thing I had remembered, but I never really understood, when did Scott Schwartz get involved?
Right. Sorry.
Because he became a co-director on the show with John Carey. Right.
Yeah. So we had done Toronto.
Right.
John had directed the show on his own. And of course, we had this very specific design that I loved.
Right.
But then by the time we got to La Jolla, you know, John was a little bit, you know, I've just directed the show 9 times in various readings and, you know, Wichita and this. And he was just like, I want a young person to come in and work with me. And one of the things that I forgot to mention was that after Toronto, when we were doing our work on the show, and we were getting all the notes from everybody, like, here's what you should work on. We had a session with Stephen Schwartz. Mm-hmm. And Stephen was absolutely fantastic. But he hadn't seen the show in Toronto. We just had a recording. So he listened to the whole recording. And I can't remember if he listened to it first or we just listened to it in the room together and went piece by piece. But I feel like Stephen's notes were the best because he just saw the show as a whole. And the big change from Toronto to La Jolla, besides a lot of book work, was de-threading the music. Because essentially in Toronto, the show was composed through. Uh-huh. You know, maybe 10 seconds where music wasn't underscoring. The show was never sung through. I'm never a fan of sung through. I don't believe in it. And uh-huh. So there was always a book, but there was always underscore and this theme to this theme. And what I learned was you need to give the audience opportunities to rest their ears musically. And that was a great note from Stephen. And that I thought was a huge improvement that we made from Toronto to Broadway is thinning out a lot of the underscore. Now, a lot of the underscore still remained, and it was so good that Steven Tyler and Larry Hockman put together, and it's such an integral part of the show to this day, but we thinned it out quite a bit, and that uh-huh. was a huge improvement that we made. And I was so grateful to Steven, and he's been such a great supporter of the show through the years. We did a reading like 2 years ago with Christy Altomare as Jane, and Stephen was there, and just again, just a fan and just so supportive. But he also said something really interesting to me after, you know, opening night on Broadway, because of course he was there to support us, and he said, you know, he said he loved the way that, you know, that I conceived this score, but, you know, I tend to write these little songlets in my scores, all my scores, especially my Austens and Jane Eyre, which I just believed in, like, I just need 12 bars to get this musical thought. It's not a whole song, but it's an important transitional moment. It's not really recit, but it serves as recit, but it's a song. And he said, people are going to have trouble with this. Critics are going to have trouble with it because they're not going to understand what you're doing. That's right. And I just so appreciated that insight. He didn't say to change it because he mm-hmm. loved it. But I understood that that's not normal. That, like, people don't do that, I guess. But I didn't know. I just went, this just feels right to do. And I still write that way, and I still believe in it. And but he was so insightful, and so great, and so supportive. And of course, his relationship with John is what set that relationship up.
Love. Love is like a virus we're infected with. You're so naive. Wouldn't it be wonderful if life were just as you perceive? Women are inhuman, worthless, coarse and savage, on the average, never to be trusted, completely maladjusted. It's true. But if I had not loved a few, I might have been as good as you. She was my flame, my galaxy. I was her fool's delight. Put me in her spell and turned my rage to trust in just one night. With appetites for pleasure, we would search for buried treasure. In the excess of temptation, I thought it my salvation, it's true. But if I had thought things through, I might have been as good as you. She found me handsome, my opera dancer, and like a fool I believed it was true. I held the world inside my hands, a man full in his prime. When she left me for another, pierced my heart a second time. Nothing lasts forever, she said. Find the door yourself, didn't won't you? Think me still your flower. I've treasured every hour, it's true. But if I had loved you too, I might have been as good as you. I came upon her sometime later. The years had not been very kind. She had this child, Adele. Said she was mine as well. Nothing lasts forever, Edward. Take good care and, oh yes, won't you? Take our lovely daughter. For you see, dear, I don't want her. But I'm still your flower. I'll just bloom elsewhere. Tell her my soul is in heaven with God. Sarah, I tell you this because I want you to know that I, with some luck, without shame, without blame, or the curse of my name, might have been as good as you.
The show opens in December on Broadway, and Tony nominations, you guys kind of plow through the winter, which is always difficult. Winter time on Broadway, people know. Right. I mean, opening in December is always tricky because after you get through the holidays, you get into that January, February mode, which is killer. Especially if the weather's bad, you've got winter season is really, really bad for ticket sales. Unless you've got like this huge box office hit. So you get to Tony nominations and almost immediately announce a closing notice because you just can't stay open. And then talk about Alanis, because I remember when that happened. It's fantastic. You guys have got nominations for Best Musical and Best Score. And Marla, not only is Marla nominated for Best Actress, but she's won the Drama Desk Award. She went out of Critics Circle, actually in a tie with Christine Ebersol that year. So she's definitely getting great note. I mean, she's getting great reviews. I mean, she's which I thought was fantastic because she was so good in the show. And she'd been with the show from the beginning. So
she was brilliant. I mean, to this day, when I think of her walking out saying, "My name is Jane Eyre," I still get chills. I see the look on her face. Mm-hmm. Her acting was brilliant. I will tell you the night of the Tonys, because that obviously was the only award we thought we were going to win. Mm-hmm. And that we should have. Mm-hmm. I will say 1,000%. I love Christine Ebersol, but Marla Schaffel absolutely 100% deserved to win the Tony Award. But Rocco Lanisman was sitting in front of her. And as soon as she lost, he turned around and said, "You know why you lost?" And he said, "Half the Tony voters didn't go see the show because they heard it was too dark." There you go.
Yeah.
But yeah, so Alanis.
Tell that story, because I remember when that happened, and I remember the outpouring of love that happened. Yeah.
So Alanis and I were
Alanis Morissette. for people who don't know who Alanis is.
So we are extremely close friends. And of course we would share our music with each other, you know, when she would write a new song or have a new album, like, you know, she'd want to play it for me. And when I was writing Jane Eyre, I would play it for her. And opening night, you know, she was right there with me opening night. It was amazing. It was so great to have her there. She's been so supportive of me. And anyway, jump cut to pre-Tonys. And I find out that the show might close. And if we do close, we cannot perform on the Tony Awards.
Right.
Why can't we perform on the Tony Awards? We're nominated for like 5 major awards. They don't want you to, like, the show's too dark. Like, this is the year of the producers. They just want light stuff. It's fun. So they were hoping that we would close before the Tonys so that we wouldn't even be on the show. So I'm talking to Alanis on the phone. I'm probably crying. And she goes, what would you need to stay open? It's the last thing I expect her to say. I'm not talking to her to say, hey, please bail the show out. I would never in a million years say that to her. And it was the last thing I expected her to say was, how much do you need? And I knew the number. And I tell her the number. And she goes, okay, let me call my manager and we'll figure it out. But I'm in. And I just, even to this day, just even thinking about it, that she just said yes. There was just no hesitation. I didn't even ask. And it was like, oh, yes, you have to be on the Tonys. So that was such an amazing feeling. And then, of course, the Tony committee fought us to still even be on the show. And they only gave us, like, what was it, a minute and 20 seconds to do our song? Never mind that, you know, Matthew Broderick and Nathan Lane were hosting the show, doing monologues, doing several production numbers from the show. That basically the Tony Awards was a big commercial for the producers that year.
Right.
And it was for them, and it was great for Broadway. I understand. But hey, give us our due. Mm-hmm. Just give us our due. And they fought so hard against that. And I remember there was this big online campaign to, like, let us do a number on the show. And we finally did. And poor Steve Tyler, our music director, was under such threat from the producers of the show, of the Tony Awards, that of this time restraint that they just kept beating into him, that the song we did was Sirens, which I wish we hadn't done that song. I wish we had done Painting Her Portrait. He played it much too fast, as you probably recall.
Mm-hmm.
And it was unlistenable. It was horrible. It was just so disappointing.
What a fool I have been to wonder if he might have a care for me. How insane the thought that you could be to him dear in any way. That a more absurd young girl has lived, I doubt that you could say. You, a favorite of Mr. Rochester, gifted with the power, your logic's fading by the hour and to no avail. Jane, poor blind puppy, had to go on dreaming, had to try to give your life some meaning, still you fail. Jane, how dare you think there's a place in his heart for you. Painting my portrait, an absolute likeness, faithful to illustrate every fine line. I'm mastering detail, highlighting defects, making a permanent mirror to see all of the faults that lie hidden in me. I'm painting my portrait. It's plain and uneven, reminding me what I am, what I must be. I'm leaving out nothing, no matter how painful. All of my flaws on display to be seen. Now my painting is done, I'll start another, this one of her. And when I close my eyes, I clearly see her face, capture her grace and poise, fight back the tears. And I'm painting her portrait, an absolute likeness, the loveliest face, the most delicate skin, a tribute to beauty, the perfect Miss Ingram. Omit neither diamond ring nor golden rose. Make her a lady of rank, glistening satin, oh, how she glows. Mix in your finest tints, paint her dramatically, with all your sweetest hues, sit here fanatically, painting our portraits. This one will live all of her life as a governess, just a lonely governess. This one will always be happy and marry a man who will carry her away. And should you fancy that he really loves you, just compare the pictures, two completely different mixtures. You should be ashamed, Jane. Why would he trade his silver for some unpolished metal? Why would he settle for a slave when he could have a queen? Jane, it's foreseen, Jane. Don't even dare anymore to compare. Say a prayer for your sorry soul, Jane.
The only upside is that I went to the Tony Awards, my only time being at the Tony Awards, and I wasn't nervous because I knew I wasn't going to win.
So, right.
So I didn't have that panic of like, what do I say? What do I do? Like, I think I'd written a speech. But like, I remember like going there going, yeah, I'm not nervous at all. I'm not nervous at all. And then as soon as the lights went down, I did get a pang. I did get nervous. Like, and I went to myself, dude, like, there's no chance. Calm down.
Mm-hmm.
So that was my night.
Right. And so the show then closes after the Tony Awards.
Yes.
After 209 performances. One of the things I want to talk to you about is because there's this really odd misconception out there that once a show closes on Broadway, it's done. It's dead. It's no longer, you know, it goes out there for licensing. It may have a national tour. If it doesn't have a tour, it's, you know, the rights are, get, the licensing is out there. It's licensed and people can now produce it, and regional theaters can do it, and high schools, colleges, community theaters can start to do it, which is basically true. But in the case of some shows, not all, but some shows, the creators often go back and rework it, and they're tinkering with it, and people don't quite understand that. They kind of scratch their heads and go, well, why do they go back? It's kind of a dead, it's dead. why are they wasting their time playing with the show? But there's been other versions of the show. First off, the fact that this show has had such an amazing life in Japan, there's been so many productions in Japan, including one in last year, 2023, which was filmed. If people go to YouTube, they can find scenes from Tokyo production from last year, which is beautifully filmed, absolutely beautifully filmed and staged, yeah, all in Japanese, which is gorgeous. But there was also one of the ones I saw that haven't seen clips of, but there was a 2018 production in Cleveland with, yes, 10 people, 10 cast members. So it was like a small chamber production.
Yes. Well, Donald, are you aware that we just did a production of Jane Eyre in Raleigh?
Yes, that was 11 also
11 cast members.
Yes, that was this past May and June.
Yes.
Directed by Megan McGinnis, who, of course, we know was in Daddy Long Legs, which is also one of your fantastic musicals, which is one of my favorites, which is also was also filmed. But she directed Julie Benko and Matt Bogart. Julie Benko, of course, everybody knows is the famous understudy from Funny Girl, who also was in Harmony this past season. But that also, you and John Caird also were involved with that production because you guys are still you guys are still working on the show. So talk about the second life of Jane Eyre, because you guys have not stopped working on this.
So I love how you put this. It's like, why do you go back? Why do authors, like, why would anybody go back? It's dead. We go back because we can.
Right.
In film and TV, you can't go back.
Right.
You know, like, you could maybe re-edit a film. You can't reshoot anything. It's just essentially going to be the same film. You know, you do a record, you're not going to re-record, you know, the White Album. You know, it's just like, it's done. Theater is a living, breathing thing. And, you know, Shakespeare is reinterpreted every time there's a production. And as long as the authors are alive on the earth and they have the desire to work on their show, they can and do. That's what I love most about theater, more than any other art form, is that you can keep working on it. I use the analogy of, it's like a lump of clay that you're molding as a sculpture. You know, you keep molding it and you keep sculpting it until it's the thing you want. And then when it's the thing you want, you can keep changing it. It's amazing. So yeah, we've never stopped working on the show. And I felt that the Cleveland production was the first version of Jane Eyre that we got right. It was the first version of Jane Eyre where act one and act two were essentially an hour. You know, maybe they were an hour five instead of an hour 20 each act. And the fact that we really paid so much attention to the music and the storytelling, because that's the only thing the show is. And we finally accepted that this is not an epic musical. It's an intimate musical. It's an intimate story. And we discovered that in Cleveland. And then Megan really, really brought that home in Raleigh. And I have to tell you that there's a lot of exciting things going on with Jane Eyre right now. Some of it I can't speak about yet, but I will tell you that there is a capture of Jane Eyre in Raleigh that look unbelievable, that you are going to get to see. And I think we are going to be able to release it to the public for free. That might be happening in a few weeks. So fingers crossed on that. But I will say the show is definitely moving forward. And I can't tell you how and where, but
You'll tell me off when we're done recording.
I will tell you off camera.
Okay. Because when I saw that was happening, I was like, that it's, because I saw that and I went, maybe they're really going to get it exactly right, because it's the kind of, when I read more about it and I saw pictures from it and I saw the cast, and I know enough about Megan that she's such a dedicated artist. And she's such a dedicated theater person. I'm like, she's the right person to get this. And I know she's got this relationship with you because she's worked with you so much that she understands your work and understands how this goes.
I cannot praise Megan McGinnis enough. Not only as an actor, an artist, a singer, a performer, but also now as a director. Mm-hmm. Now that I've worked with her as a director, she's just also a genius. I'm not really throwing that line around easily. She is a genius. I feel like we got Jane Eyre right for the first time. And I walked away going, you know, arguing with John, going, there's three things to fix now. There's three tweaks, and they're just tweaks. There's three things I want to do, John, that I know you don't want to do, that we are going to fight to the death over. But we can make some changes in rehearsal. We don't need a workshop. We don't need another big thing. It's just like, I understand what these three things are. I want to fix them. And to me, And there's small tweaks. Once we do that, I feel like this is the version of Jane Eyre I want to bring out to the world. And the version, and if we're able to share the capture of Raleigh, it's pretty damn close. And I also want to say, give love and shout out to Julie Banco and Matt Bogart, who are both amazing in the role. I'd never worked with Julie before. Not only is she an amazing human being, but what a dedicated artist. And her passion in the role and how she felt about the role and the conversations that I got to have with her, because I didn't know her at all. I'd never met her. I met her in Raleigh. And again, I instantly loved her. And she's just remarkable.
So I also want to direct people to your website, which is paulgordonmusic.com, because they will see that you are very prolific when it comes to writing musicals. You are not just Mr. Jane Eyre. You've got a lot of musicals that you have written on your website that people can take a look at. You have them, and the music has been recorded that people can sample. They can hear all the music. And I'm looking at the video they can't see. You've got Analog and Vinyl poster up behind you, and Being Earnest, and of course Daddy Long Legs, which they can actually buy the download or the CD of Daddy Long Legs. And there's also a video of Daddy Long Legs that they want to watch it, which I watched after I fell in love with the album, because there's two albums of Daddy Long Legs, right?
Yeah. So there's an original cast recording we did at the Rubicon.
Right.
Pre off Broadway.
Right.
And then there's the recording we did off Broadway, which is the one I strongly suggest people listen to, because it has Brad Hawk's new orchestrations and Paul Nolan, and it's just beautiful. And I just, you know, I'm going to tell a quick, do I have time to tell a very quick
story?
Yeah,
of course. Absolutely.
So this is just really a lesson for writers, so to speak, and composers and authors. So we did Daddy Long Legs at the Rubicon. That's where we developed it. And then when Ken Davenport came on board to develop it off Broadway, the first thing he said to us, you know, economically off Broadway and how that works, I'm sorry, your 6-piece band has to be 3 pieces. And of course, I freaked out because I had done most of the orchestration myself. And I'd written kind of an orchestration for like a 6-piece pop band. Mm-hmm. You know, it still had drums and bass in the score at that point. And when Ken said, no, you can only have 3 musicians, of course, I was very upset, going, no, don't take things away. How is this going to work? But it was a great lesson, because 3 musicians became much more powerful than 6. Brad reorchestrated the whole score and made it so much more than it had ever been. And it was a great lesson going, even when people say you have to work with less, that could actually improve what you're doing. Don't take that to mean, oh, now it's not going to work. Mm-hmm. Now it's like, I have a different set of tools. How can I make this set of tools work in this context? So that was a great lesson for that. So Megan, and also Megan did a reading of Jane Eyre where she was Jane. We did it. I'm not even going to say the theater, because they ended up not doing it. but it was great to see her do the role, and she was, of course, great.
Yeah, she's terrific, and she's really wonderful in Daddy Long Legs. If people have not heard the score for Daddy Long Legs, it's terrific. It's like I fell in love with that because I heard the Rubicon album first and absolutely fell in love with it. It was funny because the first time I heard it, I think I heard it and didn't know that it was you, because I think I just heard the album and I didn't look that close at the credits at first. I just kind of like listened to it, and then I went back and went, oh wait, this is Paul Gordon who wrote Jane Eyre. I didn't realize it at first, and then I went back and went, oh wow, this is, and I, because I loved it, absolutely loved it. It was one of my favorites. So anyway, thank you so much for coming back to talk about Jane Eyre. I've really been enjoying doing these Broadway flashback episodes so that we can kind of go back and revisit some wonderful shows and hear about, especially in the case of Jane Eyre, hear about the fact that you and John Carrot have been continuing to work on the show, and that hopefully Jane Eyre will come back new and refreshed, that, uh, that Ms. Bronte will be very excited that maybe Jane Eyre will be back. I think the problem, of course, as you said, was it got swept up in the tail end of the downswing of the big overbloated British musical thing, and it was just the wrong time. It just was the wrong time for this.
The last little tidbit I will tell you before we get off is just that I can't remember which set of producers. I'm not going to put the blame on anybody, but there was a lot of momentum to open the season that we did and not open the season before, where we could have opened against. They didn't want to be in competition with the musical Contact. So they pushed to the following season, and the rest is history.
Right.
I'll just say.
Yeah.
It's
sometimes the timing is.
And you should never guess on timing. When the show is ready, just go in. Don't imagine like, oh, it'll be easier if I go in the next year. Never say that to yourself.
You can't, because there's a lot of factors that you can't control.
Because nobody knows anything.
Exactly.
If the show is ready, you got the money, go in.
Yes. You take your chances and you just go. That's what you do.
That's right.
So thank you so much, Paul.
Thank you.
It's 7 o'clock in the morning. I lift my eyes to autumn skies. I look out through the graveyard. Silhouetted swallow flies. He flies to distant countries. I lose him just behind a cloud. I yearn to be that swallow and go where I am not allowed. Over mountains, over oceans, heaven take me away. For I long for my liberty, for sweet liberty I pray. It's 9 o'clock in the morning. I teach what's been instilled in me. But is this all we're meant for? Condemned to mere tranquility? Well, women feel as men do. We must engage our minds and souls. Let us like our brothers. Let our worth define our roles. Breaking custom and convention, let tradition give way. For we all need our liberty, for sweet liberty we pray. I wake from my bed with the urge to depart and to follow the dreams of my heart. It's 12 o'clock in the pitch black night. I can't contain my wanderlust. I seek a new adventure. I search the skies because I must. I hunger for new faces to find a better destiny and fly among the swallows far above the troubled sea. Over mountains, over oceans, heaven take me away. For I long for my liberty, for sweet liberty I pray. My hair, I look out over